So this is the second installment of our discussion, but we're going to very, very briefly recap what we mentioned the last time on one foot. Today we're going to talk about the religious Zionism great debate of the 20th century. Last time we spoke about the 19th century. The figures on the cover of this booklet, for those who are not familiar, from top left, moving clockwise, is Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk, the grandfather of Rabbi Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron, bottom right, is Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rav. The middle is Rav Shmuel Moliver, and the bottom left is Rav Aaron Cutler. And these are important figures in the discussion about the debate over religious Zionism. So last time, when we last left our heroes, we spoke about the historical background and the initial debate in the 19th century over religious Zionism. We spoke about emancipation, the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, and how that caused different reactions in the Jewish community. We saw the pre-Zionist, so to speak, movement, Rabbanim and the great thinkers. Those were Rav Alkalai and Rav Kasher in the mid-19th century. And then at the end of the 19th century, when the Zionist movement really got going, in the 1880s, the great debate between the religious Zionist Rabbanim, on the one hand, let's say Rav Reines, the founder of the Mizrahi we mentioned, as well as Rav Shmuel Moliver, and on the other side, the majority of the Rabbanim, especially in Eastern Europe, the names that we are familiar with. We mentioned the Rogachover, Rav Chaim Brisker, and many other, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe Rashab, and others who were opposed to Zionism. We spoke about some of the debates. So now we fast forward into the 20th century, whereby in the end of the 19th century, we're talking theoretical, should we establish this movement or should we not? But now you're in the 20th century and the movement is afoot. There are lots of Jews who are coming to Israel, although by the 30s, unfortunately, as you know, it's severely restricted in terms of immigration to, at that time, was called Palestine. As I mentioned last time, the purpose of this discussion is to show that there are many different approaches in Torah. It happens to be that my own personal family upbringing is one that is very much involved in the religious Zionist world. My grandfather, Olav Shalom, my father's father, in 1933, he and a group of friends of his, they lived in most of them were from the Lower East Side. They were immigrants from Galicia. They were Chassidish Yungleit. And they bought a piece of land in New Jersey and they practiced farming. And then in 1934, he forged his parents' signatures to get documents to travel to Palestine, which he did. And he spent a year working in shorts and a t-shirt under the sun, digging, building a kibbutz. And we have much, well now, my grandmother, she live and be well, she donated a lot of her, the documents that she had to the Religious Zionist Archive in Israel. So I went and I checked up with a lot of very interesting things. So this is where kind of things really got going. He came back to America, but then was involved in smuggling arms before they eventually, my grandparents made Aliyah right around the time when I was born. So now you're talking about building the yeshuv. There are now many, many Jewish communities, little ones, scattered all over the land of Israel that are sprouting up. So how do we view this enterprise? So we're going to begin with two different extreme opinions. On the one hand, we're going to begin with the opinion of page 12, which is the Sharblat, the opening page of a sefer called Vayoel Moshe that you have in front of you, authored by Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rav. The Satmar Rav of Hungarian extract. As you can imagine, Satmar is a Hungarian-Romanian community and vicinity. And we mentioned last time that the Rabbonim in Hungary were overwhelmingly anti-Zionist. Munkacs and many, many others were anti-Zionist communities. Even though we did mention at the time there was one unusual circumstance, and that was Rav Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal, who changed his view during the Holocaust. The Satmar Rav made it his, I would say, his personal rabbinic crusade to oppose the state of Israel and the resettlement of the land of Israel. And he wrote a whole book exactly on this topic. One of the primary arguments that you will see in the book, if you open to the next page in Source 13, says Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, you want to know, and he himself lost his everything in the Holocaust until after he was able to rebuild in New York and Williamsburg. He says, you know, you want to know why all these terrible things are happening? This is the Rev. Rav Yoel. He says, because of Zionism. It's obviously because of Zionists. He says, I underlined it on the top left, to Gol in the second column, Gol yu mefurish b'divrei Chazal. It is an open and shut case in the words of the rabbis. Sheigidu lanu zos beferish shalomdu mikroi. They learned from verses in the Bible where it says, Sha'al yedei ha'avara ala shvuas shalolalos b'choma. We violated the oath not to go up b'choma, in a wall, by force. And by doing that, we have incurred the divine wrath. And this is the reason for all the terrible tragedies that are happening to the Jewish people. It's because of the Shalosh Shavuos. Yeah? Why don't you pass the tape back there? Where does this come from? So look on page 14, where you will find...
It's an organizational issue.
It's not an individual issue. It's a collective issue. The problem is that the Zionist movement says, we should all go to Israel, to the land of Israel. And Rabbi Yol says, we can't do that. We are sworn not to be able to do that. And that's what the Gemara says on page 14. Says the Gemara, Rabbi Yosi Bar Chanina taught, De'omar, Gimel Shvuas Halal Ulama. Why does it say in the book of Shir HaShirim, Hishbati Eschem Benos Yerushalayim, I made you swear, the daughters of Jerusalem. What's the oath? Achas, Shelo Yalu Yisrael Bachoma. That we shouldn't go up like a wall. Va'achas sheishbiyah HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Yisrael shelo yimrdu ba'umos ha'olam. They made a swear, the Almighty made a swear, that we shouldn't revolt against the nations of the world. Va'achas sheishbiyah HaKadosh Baruch Hu es ha'ovdei kochav, and he made the idol worshippers swear, shelo yishtabdu behem Yisrael yosar midai. That the Gentiles shouldn't oppress us excessively. We'll come back to that one in a minute. But says Rav Yol Teitelman, he says it's an open and shut case. The Gemara says Beferish that we're not allowed to go back Bachoma. We can't go up as a wall and we can't resettle as a movement. And because of that, he says everything that's happening as a mass resettlement of Israel is null and void, and it's actually a Maisa Satan, it's a terrible thing. However, so that's a good question. We'll get to that in a second. So that's also a perspective we'll get from one of the Hungarian Rabbanim. But there have been many, many other, and I would say the vast overwhelming majority of other rabbinic authorities, as we will say, did not agree with Rav Yol Teitelbaum across the spectrum of perspectives, and they said that that's not a correct analysis. And there are several interesting responses, one of which I find perhaps the most fascinating is in Source 15. We mentioned last time that there was a great Gaon who lived in Dvinsk. I can't imagine Dvinsk was more than like five tin cans. But this town of five tin cans that a handful of Jews lived in had two of the great rabbinic luminaries of the beginning of the 20th century. One, his name was Rav Yosef Rosen, the Rogachev or Gaon, who was more Hasidic. There was a shtickle tied to Lubavitch. He was a wild genius. Just for one time, you should see a picture of the Rogachev. He looked lahavdil elef alfei hevdalot. He looked like Einstein. Huge, long hair. Either legend has it that he used to tie his hair to his chair that he wouldn't fall asleep when he was learning. Unbelievable. So that he was a wild genius. Unbelievable. You read his farm, it's amazing. And on the other side, you had a Lithuanian Rav, also in Dvinsk. His name was Rav Meir Simcha. Rav Meir Simcha Cohen authored a very famous rabbinic work called the Or Sameach. He also wrote a commentary on the Chumash called Meshech Chachma. So his works are very, very well known. So, in a biography, an authoritative biography of the Or Sameach, of Rav Meir Simcha Cohen, you see here a piece on page 15, authored by a fellow by the name of Zev Aryeh Rabiner, a letter that Rav Meir Simcha wrote about the circumstances that people are going to Palestine. And look at that, I'm going to skip most of it for time reasons. He alludes to Montefiore, who obviously we know was very involved in rebuilding the Yishuv. Last paragraph on the page. Omnon ke'es. Today, Heisebo ha-hashgacha, the Almighty's providence has caused asher be'osfas ha-mamlachos ha-no'oros be-San Remo. The many nations have gathered at San Remo. Here's the trivia question. What was the gathering at San Remo? What declaration may have come from
the Balfour Declaration.
The Balfour Declaration took place at a conference in 1917 in San Remo. Nitan Tzav, says the Baal Or Sameach, Asher Eretz Yisrael Tihiel Am Yisrael. And therefore, now he says, "V'kevon she'sar pachad hashvuos," the fear of the oath is gone. "Uverishon hamalachim kama mitzvas yishuv eretz Yisrael sheshkula keneged kolat mitzvas shebetorah." He says, "Now all the oaths are null and void. What was the oath that we shouldn't go and force and mass and rebel? Now, with the Balfour Declaration, we're not rebelling against anything," says Rav Meir Simcha. "We have the right, and now, consequently, we have the mitzvah to go to Eretz Yisrael." This is one response. The other response you were alluding to in this next sefer that you have here on page 16, it's called the Rav Shalom. It's a Hungarian sefer who quotes from an earlier Ungarish Rav from Kolema. I don't know where this place is. I'm probably not even Kolemeyer. I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly. What does he quote? He quotes a din in Shulchan Aruch. I'm on page 16 in the underlines. Halfway through, I have a little star. Lios ke'adim b'Shulchan Aruch yoredeya. There is a halacha on the books. Sheshnayim shenish b'uzel azeh. Two people took oaths to each other. They are joint oaths. Va'avar echor al shvuaso. And one abrogated his promise. Mutar gamla hasheni lavor shvuaso. It's permitted for the other one. He's not bound by the pre-existing oath. So let's say, I don't know, Yechiel and I, we took shvuas to each other. He took a shvua that he was gonna drive a carpool for my kids one day, and I took a shvua that I was gonna pick him up ice cream for Dairy Star tomorrow. So if I don't pick him up Dairy Star ice cream tomorrow, so he's no longer obligated to drive my kids carpool because the shvuas were interconnected. What do we see? There were three shvuas in the Gemara. The first two were, we are not allowed to go back. What was the third one? Shalishtabdu behen Yisrael yosemidai. Oppressive, excessive oppression. I ask you, how many people read about the pogroms in Russia in the 1880s? How many people cannot say that that was oppressive? How many people cannot say that what went on, and then you want to fast forward, Rachman al-Islam, you can't even open your mouth. No one, the Holy Rebbe of Klonimus Kalman, the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, writes in a later footnote in one of the drushes that he gave on Shabbos, he says, never has such destruction between the scene, even the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, as far as he knows description in Chazal. So you're going to tell me the Gemara says that that's not Yosem Midai? Obviously the Shoah, the Holocaust, is Yosem Midai. So we've now added another level to why it is that these three oaths that the Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum was so enamored with are not really necessarily valid. You could take a third level now today that they're existing. This is letter 17. This is a letter from one of the leaders of the B'nai Brak Jewish community, the rabbinic leader's name was Rav Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky, is known as the Stipler Gaon. The Stipler Gaon was asked, well, now that you have Medinat Yisrael, is it an iser to vote in the parliamentary elections in Israel? So Rav Yoel Teitelbaum said, absolutely, you may not vote, because you cannot support this Maisa Sutton. Said the Stipler Gaon, he says, now, at least once we establish the state of Israel, she'ein shulton acher l'chura leka iser mitzad gimel shvuas. You want to tell me maybe the beginning of the 20th century there was a problem of gimel shvuas, but today, once all these people have resettled and we have a state, so now again, there's another reason to say that there's no issue of gimel shvuas. So we could talk about more. If you look on page 18, you actually have a summary of 13 different responses to the Shol Shavuos, which was published years ago, Tavshin Lamed Ches, I guess 1978, by Rav Shlomo Avinir, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ateret Kohanim. He goes through 13 reasons why these three oaths are no longer binding. But this is one perspective, and you will see this out there. And if you want to know why they're doing what they're doing, so some of the people are just crazy, they're just lunatics, but some of the people really honest to goodness believe that everything that's happening is a violation of the Shalosh Shavuos. Now, whether their tactics of how they express their following of the Satmar Rav's opinion is also questionable, but there is a viewpoint that is legitimate as such. Yes?
Today, at Rei Karta, this is the reason?
So this is a big part of the reason, yeah. But they're a very, very, very fringe element. The mainstream yeshiva community does not accept this, and we'll see in a few minutes. On the opposite extreme, far, far, far away from the Satmar Rav, although living, overlapping in some years, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. So most of us are familiar with this great figure, Rav Kuk. He died in 1935. I have one more family story. When my grandfather was in Israel in 1934, he had the Seder at Rav Kook's house. Wow. Somehow, I don't know how this happened. I only found this out after he passed away. I found out almost everything about him after he passed away, because he died when I was before my bar mitzvah. But he had the Seder at Rav Kook's house in 1934, the year before Rav Kook passed away. So Rav Kook has established a whole, a whole Masorah of Torah that follows the incredible genius creativity, both halachic and machshava and philosophy, the whole world of Torah that Rav Kook has created for us. So one of the aspects of Rav Kook's teachings has to do with Eretz Yisrael, the central role that Eretz Yisrael plays, but not just Eretz Yisrael qua the land of Israel, but even a secular state and even the secular Jews. This is where it gets very interesting. After the death of Theodor Herzl, who, remember, even though he had a langa board, he was not a religious man. Do not be fooled by the picture. He was not a religious man. Rav Kook delivered a hesped. A hesped for Herzl. And he made the following statement. And if you think I'm making it up, the good thing is you have it in the page right in front of you. Rav Kook quotes from this source. Initially gets started in Gemara in Sukkah, that there are two Mashiachs. And Rav Kook is basing himself on this principle, but it becomes expanded in the Kabbalistic teachings of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was very insistent on the importance of going to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. The Vilna Gaon lived in the 18th century, and many of the students of the Vilna Gaon did settle in Israel because of that, and that's why if you go to Israel today, so many of the customs there are Minag Hagra. They follow the Gaon Rav Eliyahu of Vilna. Why? It's because his students were pre-Zionist. They were from the first ones, ironically, many of the students of the Alter Rebbe, the Baal Shem disciple, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, many of them came to. So you'll have Minhag of Balatanya and you'll have Minhag HaGra. Those are very strong Minhagim in Israel. Why? Because they were from the earliest people who lived there. And the other strong Minhag is Sephardic custom, because many of the Sephardic Jews came there in the 16th century after the expulsion. So the Vilna Gaon was very into this concept, and his students in a sefer called Kol HaTor came up with a developed theme that there are two Mashiachs. There's Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Now, according to the Kabbalah, Mashiach ben Yosef will die, and Mashiach ben David will be the ultimate redeemer. But the Mashiach ben Yosef is the first, he's going to fight the battles, the first level of redemption. Says Rav Kook, something astonishing. He says, we are living in a day, and you see it on page 19, where we can look to this model, because we know there are two models, Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. So I gave you the beginning. This is called HaMispeid B'Yerushalayim. This is in Tafresh Samach Dalid. He says, Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David, we need both. Says Rav Kook, what are the ideas? Mashiach ben Yosef builds the physical structure. That's what it means when they say that the Mashiach ben Yosef fights the wars. He builds the chomer, the physical, and then the Mashiach ben David will add the spiritual. We need both, says Rav Kook. Says Rav Kook on the next page. I gave you the whole thing so you could read it through, share it later. V'hine, b'tor ikvasa de Mashiach ben Yosef, in our generation of Mashiach ben Yosef, Nizgala Chizyon Hatzionus Bidorenu. Zionism, secular Zionism, is Mashiach ben Yosef. Theodor Herzl is Mashiach ben Yosef, because he is building a physical foundation. This is Letzad HaKloli B'Yoser. This is the general economic basis, the social basis, the military basis, subsequently, this is the basis of the Geula. First, you have Mashiach ben Yosef. Obviously, says Rav Kook, you have to have Mashiach ben David. You have to fill it with tochen ruchani. You have to have a spiritual content. But the first level, says Rav Kook, not just that we tolerate the secular Zionists, not just that we'll cooperate with them because we have something to gain and we can work with them. No, the secular Zionists themselves have great spiritual worth. And this is part of an overall approach that Rav Kook has to Kodesh and Chol. But this is a total opposite perspective. Some have suggested, when I was in Kerem Yavne, one of the Rabbeim gave a a talk that suggests, I think it was from Kalman Baer, who suggested that was the Pshat of Bar Kokhba. Rabbi Akiva said Bar Kokhba is Mashiach. If you look into the story of Bar Kokhba, he was not exactly the most religious person. He didn't have the highest moral fiber. But perhaps, because the Gemara says in Yerushalmi, all right, just 2 second digression, they said to Rabbi Akiva, Yalu asavim bilachayayich va'adayin ben David loba. Rabbi Akiva, you will be buried 6 feet under, grass will be growing from your body, and Ben David will not be here. So they suggested, you're right. They were saying to him, Rabbi Akiva, maybe this man is Mashiach ben Yosef. Maybe you're right, this is the drasha. Maybe it's Mashiach ben Yosef. But look at the spiritual landscape here. Look what's happening. Ben David, the spiritual, is way, way far off. So you got to just forget about this whole Bar Kokhba thing. And as we know, unfortunately, it didn't quite pan out. So Rav Kook sees the secular Zionists as a religious phenomenon. And not only that, if you look on page 21, a piece from Orot, where he says, again, in concert with this idea that you need to build the physical to fill it with spiritual, Lemaloa shel she'ifazu, in the middle paragraph here, I have it in English on the bottom, but here's the Hebrew, Tzorech davka shetzibur yizeh yeh bal medina politit v'socialit. We need to have a national identity. Well, you're going to have a national identity. You have to have a state and you have to have a society. So these are two, I would say, great figures with very, very different ideas. Well, what about the mainstream? What about your average, not average, but the big, big community of Rabbonim in the middle? So if you move past the 30s into the 40s with the advent of the State of Israel, you will find almost a unified approach. Vast, vast, overwhelming majority. In a letter, two letters, signed by a collection of scores of Rosh Yeshiva, community rabbis, Rabbanim, and Admorim, Hasidic Admorim, throughout Israel, signing on to a letter. Now, you wouldn't believe me if I didn't show it to you. So it's on page 21. This letter is published January 21st, 1949. Starts on 21, goes over to 22. I only gave you two pages, but it goes much longer. The signatories, most of the names here I'm not even familiar with. It's in January 21st, 1949, preparing for the elections. The undersigned rabbis say that everybody should vote for one party. There was one religious party. Everybody, the Hasidim, the Misnagdim, the Sfardim, the Ashkenazim, the Mizrahi, everybody participated in one party. If that didn't bring the Mashiach, I don't know. One religious party. And they all signed, and what did they say about the new state of Israel? It is Hanitzanim HaRishonim Shel HaAschalta DeGeula Im HaKamasa Shel Medinas Yisrael. It's not the Geula, but to say this is the first flowering, the Nitzanim HaRishonim, of the beginnings of the redemption. That's your hedging. It's the beginning of the flowering, of the beginning of the Geula, but that's a bold statement. You go into many, many, many communities today, and you ask them, is the state of Israel the beginnings, I don't care how early, and don't tell me that Maisa Bereishis is also the beginning of the Geula, the beginnings of the Geula. So if you ask this question in 1949, and you turn to page 22, you can give people a few names to drop. Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank, the Av Bezin Yerushalayim, the author of the Shilas and Tshuvas Har Tzvi and the Chidushim, very, very well-respected general posting. We call that from the, I would say, the old school community, Yeshuva Yashan, the Haredi community. Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalav from Merkaz Harav. Rav Yecheskel Sarna, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chevron Yeshiva, Knesset Yisrael, also known as Slabodka. You go to Slabodka, Rav Yecheskel Sarna will tell you, this is the Nitzanim HaRishonim of the Aschalta de Geula. Rav Yechiel Michal Tukachinsky, Rav Meshulam Roth, the author of the Tshuvas Kol Mavasser from Bnei Brak, and one of my personal heroes in life, on the third column, the underline, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Died about 15 years ago. Undisputed leader of world Jewry. 1949, in Israel, all these Rabbonim, including all, I didn't give you pages of Admorim from this Chassidus and that Chassidus, they're all saying, this is the beginning of the Aschalta de Geula. And it's not just in Israel, it's also in America. So if you look at page 23, I love this story. This is a piece out of the article biography from Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz, who was one of the chief architects of Jewish education in America. He was the menahel of a yeshiva called Torah Vadas in Brooklyn, which was one of the few yeshivas that existed in the first half of the 20th century, with many, many famous Talmidim, many famous Rosh Yeshiva, and he was very involved in Torah Mesorah and education all over the world. So after the UN declaration, Sir Shraga Feivel, 4 days later, he spoke in Beis Medrash Elyon, which was like a branch of Torah Vadas, which still is a branch of Torah Vadas, talking about, obviously nobody could say with certitude, he reflected that this has the potential for being the Geula, and he suggested why perhaps the Zionists may play a fateful role in this redemption. Now, the bold is where it gets interesting. In a conversation with the Satmar Rav shortly after his talk on the UN Declaration, Rav Shraga Feivel was subjected to the sharpest criticisms for his Zionist leanings. Later, he told his family, "I could have answered him Chazal for Chazal, Medrash for Medrash, but I did not want to incur his wrath, for he is a great man and a tzaddik." He added with a twinkle, "And besides, he has a fiery temper." So, in Torah Vadas, we're seeing this as the potential for Geula. You move over to Rav Soloveitchik, who there's a lot been written, there's a whole essay by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, "Should Live and Be Well," on his father-in-law, on his views on religious Zionism. But he has a famous essay that was published in 1956, viewing this as Kol Dodido Fake, the knocking of my beloved. This is a fundamental, very, very important essay to understand Rav Soloveitchik's position on the Holocaust, as well as on the State of Israel. It's much easier than some of his other writings. I'm not an expert by any means, and I haven't read a lot, but I've read some. This, for me, at least, is digestible. At least, for a regular person like me to understand it, I got it. I got this piece. It's long. It's like 55 pages. So it's not, you know, a five-minute read, but the Rav talks here about the six knocks. How can you see that this is the Yad Hashem? Forget Maisa Satan, this is the Yad Hashem, mamish. The first part of this essay is about the Shoah, about the Holocaust. Now comes the Rabbono Shlomo, he says the Rav is knocking on our door. Six knocks, he identifies. Clearly telling us this is the hand of God. I'm on page 24 in the packet, 31 in the bottom in this edition of Kol Dodido Fake. First, the knock of the beloved was heard in the political arena. No one will deny that the rebirth of the State of Israel in a political sense was almost a supernatural occurrence. I love the next quote. It says, "I am inclined to believe that the United Nations was especially created for this end, for the sake of fulfilling the mission that divine providence has placed upon it. It appears to me," this is the Rav said in 1956, I'm not sure it's changed since then, but who am I to say, "that one cannot point to any other concrete accomplishment on the part of the United Nations," says the Rav. You know why the UN is here? Just to give Haskama to the State of Israel. That itself is a miracle. Number two, it was heard on the battlefield, the knock. The miracle of the many delivered into the hands of the few and materialized before our eyes. An even greater miracle happened. God hardened the heart of Ishmael and commanded him to go into battle against the State of Israel. This is also seven armies against a bunch of poorly armed Jews. Third, the beloved also began to knock on the door of the tent of theology. And perhaps this is the strongest beckoning, which for some of us, at least for me, this is not so, I'm not so knowledgeable about Christian theology, but Christian theologians to the fact that the Holy One has taken away from the community of Israel its rights in the land of Israel. So many Christians said, "You're not the Amanifchar anymore. It's been given away." So now we come back, says the Rav, all of a sudden we say to the Christians, "Ma pitom." Fourth, the beloved knocks in the heart of the youth, which is assimilated and perplexed. The period of Hester Ponim in the 1940s brought confusion among the, page 27 now, the Jewish masses and especially the Jewish youth. Suddenly the beloved began to beckon to the hearts of the perplexed, and his beckoning, the establishment of the State of Israel, at least slowed the process of flight. The fifth knock, bottom of 37 here, the fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important. For the first time in the annals of our exile, divine providence has amazed our enemies with the astounding discovery that Jewish blood is not cheap. 25, going over to, you'll read this by yourself, 29. Just skip two pages. We're just going to do the last one for purpose of time. The sixth beckoning, of which we could also not lose sight, was heard at the time of the opening of the gates of the land of Israel. A Jew escaping from an enemy's land now knows that he can find refuge in the land of his forefathers. Says the Rav, the Ribono Shalom is knocking at our door, so what do we need to do? Turn to the next page, 30. We need to answer. The story of Shir HaShirim is about this girl. She took a shower, she laid down, she's in her pajamas, she doesn't want to get her feet dirty, she doesn't get up when the boyfriend is knocking at the door. She says, Pashatati eskutati echacha el bashena. I'm already not dressed, I'm lying down, when am I going to get up? He's at the door. Finally, she realized this is the night that she's been waiting for somebody to come knock at her door. She's been chasing this guy for all of her life. So kamti anilo til leftoach didlodi. She comes to open the door and he's gone. Bikashtiu v'lomitzasiu. He's gone by the time she opens the door. Says the Rav, we can't let that happen. We have to respond. And that's what he says in 31 and 32, 33. We're not going to 32. Says Rav Soloveitchik, the fact that Jews have conquered the negative is not enough. The settlement is what is important. He goes on to point out, American Jewry, we need to stand up and get involved in settling the land. We need to be serious about that. And you could talk about that more. Further, later on in his life, although not till the end of his life, at a certain point he stepped back, Rav Soloveitchik became the president of the Mizrahi, and he gave four talks in Yiddish called Fear Drushes, four talks, and then he added a fifth, and it was translated into Hebrew, then translated to English, called The Rav Speaks, and he gave five talks about the Mizrahi movement. And in one of these talks, this one in page 33, he talks about this idea of the machlokas between the two different opinions, the Mizrahi and the larger Jewish religious establishment, and he identifies, he suggests that the Mizrahi is the personification of Yosef. See, Yosef looked at all the brothers and he says, I see all kinds of things. I see living in a land where we're going to have to harvest and we're going to have to deal with animals and all kinds of economic situations that we haven't seen before. And the brothers say to him, what are you talking about, Shaita? Fool. This is where we are. But Yosef has a dream. He has a dream that something is coming. But nobody else heard him. Bereshit sends him down to Mitzrayim. Hu ha-shalit al ha'aretz, hu ha-mashbir l'chol am ha'aretz. Had Yosef not gone down there, what would have happened to us in exile? Finished. But Yosef sets up the ability for Jews to interact and maintain their identity in exile. That's the Yosef model. The first man, outside, he follows Yaakov who had been in love him, but now he's alone by himself. Yosef sets it up. So at the end of the day, we're not going to decide who's right and who's wrong, Elu ve'elu, but we see that settling the land and being able to develop these technological advances, we have to fill it with Torah, we have to get the religious community involved, we can't stand at the sidelines. But this is the religious Zionist philosophy of Rav Soloveitchik. So here we are, very into the idea. If you go to Tells in the 1950s, which did not yet exist in Chicago, but it existed in Cleveland. So there were Rav Bloch, who was the Rosh Shiva and Tells, participated in the Yom HaAtzmaut parade in Cleveland. This is the way it was. But perhaps things have changed. So why have they changed? So probably there are many factors. I sat with Rabbi Ralph Pelkovitz, should live and be well, who himself learned in Israel. He went to Israel when he was like 12 years old. Without his father, who was a rabbi in Bridgeport, he went with his mother and his two sisters. They went to Israel. He went to the Chevron Yeshiva that I mentioned before, the illustrious Chevron Yeshiva. He went to the high school there, and he has a lot of experience in life. He's over 90 years old. He's a very wise person. So I sat with him last Pesach, and I was talking about this. I just asked him. I said, "What happened? How did it change?" See, he said many different things, but one of the aspects that we can identify that changed is that over time, what initially we thought was the doorstep of Geula hasn't quite materialized the way that we hoped it would. As a community, as a religious community, the institution, the state, the society as a whole, the concept, it hasn't progressed the way that we would have liked it to be. So Rav Aaron Kotler has on page 35 a mashal. He says, I'll share it with you outside. says, I'll tell you two men. Imagine we go back, and it's appropriate now because we're in the 3 weeks. You have two men who are living at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. One of them is a farmer. He lives up somewhere in Beit Shan. And what does he have? He has sheep. He has a house, a little hut. He has a field. He has crops, a donkey. That's what he has. And then you have somebody who lives in Yerushalayim, who every day he comes out to Daven Shacharis at the Beis HaMikdash. He sees miracles. He sees the Kohen Gadol. He sees people coming Aliyah LeRegel. He sees the most unbelievable spiritual highs. So comes the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and everything is destroyed, wiped away. The man in Beit Shan, he has no more sheep, he has no more goat, he has no more house, he has no more farm. And the man in Yerushalayim, he has no more house, he has no more farm, he has no more Beis HaMikdash, no more Kohen Gadol. And then they come and rebuild. Now they're going to have a political state. They're going to get a couple of people together. We're going to build a country for ourselves. So now the man in Beit Shan, so he has his goat, he has his sheep, he has his hut, and he has his field. So he's okay. But the guy who lives in Yerushalayim, how does he feel? So he has his house, but where's his Beis HaMikdash? Where's his miracles? Where's his Kohen Gadol? Where's his Shacharis? Says Rav Aaron Kotler, on the one hand, all right, if your expectations, if your hopes or dreams are a donkey and a goat and a field, so we have it. But if your hopes and your dreams are Beis HaMikdash and miracles and Shechina, so we don't have that. And there is another interesting level to this perspective, which is cited by, in page 36, I mentioned him once in a talk before. His name is Rav Shagar, Rav Shimon Gershon Rosenberg, who passed away just a couple of years ago. Very, very brilliant, radical thinker. And he's very real. I don't think I understand 10% of what he writes. It's way, way beyond me. But the 10% that I understand, it's pretty amazing. And it really speaks to me because he's a very real type of thinker. He's extremely philosophical. That's why most of the things I don't understand. But he says, why is it that so many people are not observing Yom HaTzimut and Yom Yerushalayim? He says, why is it? And why is it, he says, that the observance that we have of Yom HaTzimut and Yom Yerushalayim, it's very strange. It's not uniform. I personally find that it's very strange that you go to one place and the night of Yom HaTzimut, they're blowing a shofar, and then you go somewhere else and they're saying hallel, and somewhere else they're not saying hallel, but they're saying l'chadodi. So you have, it's like somewhere between, and it's just the reality. At least to me, it feels like, I don't know, I'm missing Askinu Sudasa. I'm missing something. It's just like a random hodgepodge of things. We don't have one uniform observance. Why is that? So he quotes a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says that Chizkiyahu had an amazing salvation. Chizkiyahu was literally at the doorstep of death because the whole Assyrian army was encamped around Jerusalem. And the Ribbono Shel Olam causes a miraculous victory. These people all die and they leave. So Gemara says, Chizkiyahu, he didn't sing Shira. Didn't say a song to God. And the angels were saying, wow, this is crazy. How come he didn't sing a song? The earth says, I'm going to sing a song, says the Gemara. I'm going to sing a song to God to thank. And the earth sings a song. And the Gemara says, you know what? Because Chizkiyahu didn't sing a song, he's not the Melech HaMashiach. Chizkiyahu, says the Gemara in Sanhedrin, he would have been the Melech HaMashiach, but now, scrap him from the list. Because he didn't sing a Shira. So the question is, so why didn't he sing a Shira? He couldn't sing a Shira, and the land, again, whatever that means, mystically sang a Shira. So the Maharal says he couldn't sing a Shira. Why couldn't he sing a Shira? Says Rav Shagar, he says, I'll explain it to you. It's very profound. He says, Chizkiyahu, he's a man with a soul, with a spirit. That's what he says here. He has a shlemut elyona. He has a high spiritual aspiration. So he looks out there and he says, yeah, all these people are dead. They're all gone. But what's with the land? It's destroyed. Almost every single inch of the land had been now totally evacuated of Jews by the Assyrians over many years. says, yes, he was saved, but the fullness of the miracle, he says, I see too many holes. Says Rav Shagar, the land doesn't have any soul, it doesn't have any spirit. The land is one dimensional. You look at it from one dimension, you're going to sing a song. But if you look at it from the full picture of Shlemut, this tzaddik who has a high level of spirituality, it's not that he has kafui tov, it's just that he can't because he's so pained. It's interesting that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook describes that after the initial declaration saying that there would be a state of Israel by the UN, he says he couldn't go outside to celebrate. He was depressed in his own house. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the Rashi of America's a Rav. Why was he depressed? He says, because they cut the land of Israel in half. Only when Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap came and visited him, told him, we have to go celebrate, did he go celebrate. He couldn't bring himself to celebrate. So part of the perspective of the overall community is a lofty spiritual perspective that says, we're not going to make a holiday because we have Chad Gadya, because we have one goat. So that's one very important, legitimate perspective. Now, that's not the whole story, but that is one place where you go. Unfortunately, that perspective may also lead to a lack of Hakaras HaTov, because if you don't say Shira, that doesn't mean you can't say thank you. You know? So it's a good question about Chanukah and Purim, and it's a perfect segue, because you bring us to Rav Amital, and that's where we're going to kind of land. Rav Yehuda Amital, another postmodern complex figure in the world of religious Zionism, he delivered a talk. I think for some this was a controversial talk, but it's a very, very down-to-earth talk. And he says, you want to know why we should celebrate on Yom HaAtzmaut? You're right, it's not perfect. You're right, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. You're right, we have a barn and a goat and we have a field. But wait a second. Look at the Chashmonaim. Look at the Rambam. The story of the Chashmonaim is not a pretty picture. I mean, it's pretty when you talk about Hanukkah, the lights, very nice, the dreidels, we eat latkes. Latkes are good, right? And they did... I'm not saying anything that wasn't miraculous. I thought it was miraculous. It was a huge miracle. In the times of 167, 163, 161 BCE, this was an unbelievable miracle. Rabban Ba'amatim. The Chashmonaim were from the greatest history, the greatest heroes of Jewish history. But they went sour. They went sour, the Ramban says in Parashas Vayechi, because they dominated the political system. And they were Kohanim. They belonged serving in the Beis HaMikdash, not running a political establishment. Well, what happens when you get too much politics and too much religion too close together? So that ends up with Kohanim Gedolim that are bought and sold by auction, a Beis HaMikdash that's in shambles, people dying in the Beis HaMikdash, terrible infighting. It's not a pretty picture. It's not a good situation. You need both. You need a political system and a religious system, and they need to work together. That's why the Malchus and the Kohuna are right next to each other. But you can't have Kohanim running the political establishment, and you can't have the political machers running the Beis HaMikdash. They have to have the respective realms. So at the end of the line, by the time the year 70 comes around, the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, there are zero descendants of the Chashmonaim extant. They all die out. The Gemara says in Bava Basra, there's one girl, she either is committed suicide or she's killed by Herod. She's the end of the line. So what are you going to say? We're going to celebrate Chanukah. Let's all celebrate Chanukah. Why are we going to celebrate Chanukah? At the end of the day, the story of Chanukah is a big tragedy. We don't like to look at it that way. So it was good for a few minutes, a couple of decades, but then it went sour. So the Rambam says that Chazra Malchus LiYisrael Yeser Al Masayim Shana. The hegemony, the monarchy, returned to Israel more than 200 years. That's what the Rambam writes in the beginning of Hilchos Chanukah. And you ask yourself, the Rambam is not a historian. He's a halachist. He's just writing a code of law. The answer is, apparently for the Rambam, this was important. The historical background of the miracle of Chanukah and the subsequent rule of the Chashmonaim as political leaders, that was important for the halacha. We are going to celebrate that too. They were Rishoim, Rachman and Litzlan, doesn't matter. Because the institution of a political autonomous body in Israel, that itself is cause for celebration, even if it's not perfect. Look, you can go back to the Tanakh, open a Tanakh. How many of the kings of Israel and how many kings of Yehuda How many of them were super righteous? And unfortunately, how many of them were corrupt or wicked? Rahman al-Islam. So says Rav Amital, you're right. It ain't perfect. But the Second Temple period thus serves as a legitimate model. I'm on page 38 before the second section, by which we may assess the contemporary Jewish state a half a century after its establishment. This was a talk he gave in 1996. He just passed away a couple of years ago. How can we not thank the Almighty for all the kindnesses He has showered upon us? First and foremost, the state of Israel serves as a safe haven for 5 million Jews. After the nightmare of the Holocaust, he himself, his name was Klein growing up. He came from Hungary, Romania, I forget which. He was in a work camp, and then he did make it to Israel. Says he saw with his own eyes the destruction of the Holocaust. Today, too, the state plays a role in a Kiddush Hashem. He says, ultimately, the Holocaust was the worst of all possible Chil Hashem. State of Israel is a tikkun, a Kiddush Hashem to some degree. The emotional attachment to the state remains a final thread connecting them to the Jewish people and to the God of Israel. It's the restoration and the revitalization of the Jewish people. You can read this on your own. It's tremendous. Says Rav Amital, we cannot be blind, and we are not going to be blind to the areas in which the state of Israel is falling short and faltering on a spiritual level. A more just and stronger public values are necessary, etc. Closing social gaps. And hopefully we believe that the state will develop into this idea. But despite the fact that there are these shortcomings, there's still on which to say a hallel and a thanksgiving. So these are, I think, a wide lens of perspectives that you will find out there over the last 50 years. Today, it's been a little bit shifted because over so many decades of disinterest from many because of the disillusionment and the Chizkiyo situation, you also have an unfortunate situation of apathy, which itself, I think, is terrible. If you believe that it's a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam, you go to Ponovich and rewind the clock many years. Go to Ponovich in the life of the Ponovich Rav, of Yosef Kahaneman, who escaped the inferno just barely. He had a flag flying in the Ponovich yeshiva every year. So Rabbi Pelkovitz told me that his second wife once came to him and said that she saw that some of the boys had taken down the flag. So he went out and told them they have to absolutely put it back. So times have changed, and feelings have changed, but the perspectives are still legitimate. You have on one extreme, so you have Rav Yol Teitelbaum, he says the whole thing is a Maisa Satan, so it's a Maisa Satan. You have Rav Cook on the other hand, who says that, look, even the Ministry of Tourism, bringing people, even the Ministry of Economy, even the secular people who are, whatever they're doing, that also has religious significance. And then you have the viewpoints in the middle, Rav Soloveitchik saying it's an opportunity. These Rabbanim saying it's a Nitzanim HaRishonim HaSchal Degula, let's get involved and see this as an opportunity. And then you have the postmodern layers of today saying, okay, it's not perfect. We see it 65 years later. Maybe it's not what we dreamed of. So how do you relate to it? Do you say, look, I can't say Shira. I'm not really going to engage it. Maybe something will come of it, but it doesn't look like so much. Or do you say, no, we appreciate the gift that it is, the significant religious contribution that it is. We're going to say hallel for that. And then hopefully we're going to build going further. So there's a lot more to say that you can say about this topic, but this, I think, is just a cursory survey of some of the perspectives on this important issue of religious Zionism.